Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, good evening, and welcome to Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. I'm your host, Joy Keys, and I want to thank you so much for tuning in. You can follow me on Twitter, at Joy Keys, or you can check me out on Facebook, Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys, and on Instagram, Saturdays with Joy Keys. Also, email me, SaturdaysWithJoyKeys@hotmail.com. And we're on Spotify, we're on Stitcher, we're on iTunes, we're on Amazon Music, we're on Google, we're on iHeartRadio. If you miss a show, they're there, they're archived. I want to let you know that this show is a very sensitive show. We're going to be talking about child abuse, sexual assault. So if you have gone through these things or you might know someone, this show may be triggering for you, and you may or may not want to listen, or maybe listen at a different time now that you know that this is what we're going to be talking about. I have an expert with me today. Her name is Aisha Shahida Simmons. She's an award-winning black feminist lesbian cultural worker who has examined the intersections of race, gender, sexuality, and sexual violence for over 25 years. She is a survivor of childhood and adult sexual violence, but she is committed to healing and non-carceral accountability. She's the editor of the 2020 Lambda Literary Award-winning anthology, Love with Accountability, Digging Up the Roots of Child Sexual Abuse. And that's what we're going to be talking about this evening. She also has a movie called Know the Rape documentary, and she was on the show previously talking about that. So if you look up us, you could probably find that interview as well, where we talk about the film. And she also has a website, so we're going to talk about all of that and how to connect with her and the different resources that she has available. Good evening, Aisha.
Good evening. I'm really happy to be back on the show, Joy. Thank you so much for the invitation to talk about my work.
Well, it's not going anywhere, unfortunately. I actually wish I couldn't. I didn't have to have you on the show. you understand?
I hear you. I wish I didn't have to talk about it.
You know what I mean? We were talking previously before the show started, and I said in the book it talks about, you know, transformative justice, one of the issues. And what does that look like? And people are talking about education in schools to kids about, you know, sexual abuse. And I said, we don't even learn how to get an apartment, but we want people to talk about sexual abuse in school? Yeah. Like, I mean, we are fighting about if you teach somebody about sex, then you're going to start telling them that they're going to have sex. But one in four women have been abused.
Right.
That's
right.
Reported.
And one in six boys have been abused.
One in six boys, and that is reported, and that is another issue. All these statistics are based on reported, documented cases, and we know based on your work and others, many, many people don't report. So,
right.
You know, so let me start with you and your story. Why did you decide to make this movie? Why are you making this collection of stories? What was the catalyst for this?
Well, the catalyst, at the time I started making Know, the rape documentary, it was in the 90s, and I thought I just wanted to help all of those black women survivors out there. I didn't think it had anything to do with me. But it was a 12-year journey, and I realized that actually in making the film, I was actually saving myself because I am a survivor of rape as a college sophomore and then also of childhood sexual abuse. And so I worked on that film from 1994 to 2006, 12 years. It was groundbreaking at the time. It had its world premiere at the Pan-African Film Festival in Los Angeles in February 2006. This was 19 months before Title IX was successfully used in terms of against campus sexual assault. I mean, Know was very much a precursor. It was before the incredible viral recognition of the Me Too movement. It was before surviving R. Kelly in terms of just breaking the silence. And all of this, like I see all, know as well as all the works I've just talked about, and then so many works like For Colored Girls by Intozake Shange or The Color Purple by Alice Walker. This is a continuum of work that Black women have been doing for a long time around breaking silences around sexual violence and celebrating our healing and resilience. So Now Know is subtitled in Spanish, French, Portuguese, and German. I've made it accessible for a dollar rental online on Vimeo. All that information is on the website, knowtherapedocumentary.org. And so for me, what I've been very interested in is amplifying the voices of Black women survivors, amplifying the work in Black communities to disrupt and end this violence, and also working, exploring ways how to do this without relying on the same systems, the criminal justice system, that we know has just done, wreaked so much havoc and harm in our communities.
Now, do you feel you have healed more now, less now, the same? How was your healing today based on from before you even started the film?
Oh, yeah. No, let me just say, in terms of my journey, I was assaulted, my adult journey, young adult journey, I was assaulted, raped in my sophomore year in college. And so I, and then I subsequently dropped out of school because I just could not function and deal. So, and that, and we don't talk a lot about that in terms of how many of us, you know, our formal education was cut short as a result of that. I started therapy about 2 years before I started working on No. So I'm a proponent of therapy. For 28 years, I worked with one Black feminist licensed clinical psychologist, and now I'm working with a new therapist, another Black woman, that I can't imagine doing this work without therapy. I also am a long-term Buddhist meditation practitioner, so meditation and also mindfulness teacher. Meditation has been instrumental in my healing process. And I will say that the film Know, that whole process has led me and played a role in my healing process. And in fact, at the end of Know, there's a closing dance sequence, and the refrain is rage, meditation, action, healing. So really, because I want to acknowledge the rage that what happens against our will, the violation, the invasion of our bodies, and then the importance to either meditate or pause if you don't want to meditate or pray, just to pause so that we can discern what's happening, to breathe, and then we can take action, right, and ultimately heal. And that's really, for me, how I see my work. My goal is healing.
Now, the title of the book is called Love with Accountability. Who is being accountable, and who are we loving?
Thank you for that question. For me, because the book focuses on childhood sexual abuse, who've been impacted, and I am a survivor of childhood sexual abuse, we are impacted by people that we know and may have loved before the abuse. We may love them after, but definitely before the abuse, that they are our loved ones, most of whom have been put in whose responsibility is our care. So the love with accountability, actually, it comes from my own healing process. My parents did not sexually abuse me, but my grandfather did, and I told my parents what happened, and they are divorced, and they were divorced at the time when I was 10. I am now 53 years old, and I told them, and they didn't remove me from the situation. So this has just been a really intense period, and it wasn't until 2015. Now, I shared a few minutes ago that I finished my film at 2006. It wasn't until 2015 that I came to grips with the fact of my parents' bystanding role to my abuse. By this point, my grandfather had been, he's an ancestor, and I actually played a role in saving his life when he was gravely ill. But I realized that while my grandfather definitely committed the acts and the harm against my body as a child, 10 to 12 years old, that my parents allowed it to happen after I told them. They didn't know before, but once I told them. And so the love with accountability really came out of my own meditative practice because my parents at the time were not really wanting to deal with my rage and anger. I mean, we all had established that what Pop-Pop did to me was wrong, but they didn't see how they were involved. And so the word love with accountability came up through my own meditative practice, and that's how I started responding to them in my communiques, because I was saying, because they, what was being said and what is often said to most survivors by family, if you love us, you'll move on. If you love us, you'll stop talking about
this. Get over it.
And so what I was saying that, yes, I love you, but my love is not going to shield you from accountability for the harm. So love with accountability is that's where that comes from. And I think that love with accountability can transcend a conversation around childhood sexual abuse, but that's where the term, that's how it emerged in terms of, like, what does love with accountability, those of us who've been really harmed by our family, right, by people who we trusted who as kids, and then how do we hold these people accountable?
I like you said, the words love with accountability can transcend this issue of child abuse in any loving relationship. And it actually brings me to that idea of, you know, they say, well, hurt people hurt people. Now, for a long time, that was what people said, you know, well, that's why he did it. You know, he was hurt, so that's why he did it. Mm-hmm. But then there's people, and there are therapists and psychologists and social workers that say, okay, you know you were hurt. Go get some help. You can't no longer use that hurt people excuse. They'll say that was an excuse because you know you were hurt. So you have to, you know, go get some help and take care of that. So, I mean, for me, that's where that's one area of accountability. But in a relationship where there is no abuse at all, people still need to be accountable. If you're married, you know, your husband and wife, there are certain accountabilities. It doesn't matter.
And
you
in
know,
partnership,
you have to pay the rent,
friendship.
Partnership, business, all types of things. But, in, you know, family, you know, parents, all these things. You, as a parent, you have to hold them accountable for keeping you safe, feeding you, clothing you, hopefully protecting you from abuse, but that cannot always be the case. It happens without their knowledge many a times. But the other part is once you do tell them, and this is many of the stories, almost I would say 3/4 of your stories, people told and they weren't believed. It was so amazing to me. Like, I had to keep putting the book down like, oh, here we go again. Here we go again with this. What the hell? You know? I want to start real basic quickly, though. People may not understand what does child abuse mean. I'm a licensed social worker. I had to take a 3-hour class about what child abuse is. And it is not just if somebody touches a child. It also is if the child touches another person inappropriately in their genitals or in a sexual manner, if they're forced to watch pornography, if they're talked to about inappropriate sexual things, even if nothing is touching them, that is also child abuse. Neglect is child abuse. Not taking care of them, not providing food, clothing, and shelter is also abuse. There's also physical abuse of, say, disciplinary types of abuse. That is also abuse, too. And so there's many forms of child abuse that people may not be aware of. And one of the things that is talked about is you talk to your kid, if anybody touches you in your special area, come see mommy or daddy. But we may not talk about pornography. We may not say if they ask you to look at a picture. We may not say if they ask you to touch them. And sometimes kids are very literal. So mommy said, if somebody touches me, I'm supposed to come talk to her. But nobody touched me. I touched them. Like, you know, so there has to be education for parents and people who are in charge of children as well on what does that mean. Let's read some of the books. Can you read some of them from the book?
I will, and I want to just kind of share. So the anthology is, features writings by 40 diasporic Black survivors and advocates, and it's broken up into sections, every five chapters, I have the word breathe, because it's intense. It's intense reading, and it's really important that we take care of ourselves while we read through the book. My call, my invitation to everyone in who contributed to the book was inviting them to share what happened when they were harmed, abused as children, but also to envision what a world would look like without childhood sexual abuse. How can we end this? So for me, it was very important that we not just solely focus on the trauma, but that we actually use what a dear friend of mine and writer, Walida Imarisha, calls speculative fiction, that we envision that which has not occurred. Because I think that when we think about enslavement, for instance, you know, in terms of our ancestors never probably, you know, could imagine what's happening right
where
now.
Where we are
I
today.
Do believe,
mm-hmm.
Right. I do believe that many of them believe at some point my people will be free. And for me, what I want is I'm creating work that to a point where there will be a generation, I'm sure not in my lifetime, that will look back and be like, people did this. So that was really important. The other thing I want to say is that my mother is a contributor to the anthology, that after she, as well as my father, later came to grips with their bystanding roles, that she is a survivor of sexual violence, and she's a scholar, and she's a women's rights activist. So she writes about not protecting me. And I think that that's very powerful. I view it as an opportunity for all parents and caregivers to really confront if they did not protect their children, to really be accountable. Because as I said, I'm 53. This in 2015, I was 46. So we're not talking about as a child. So she writes about this as, you know, now about the healing work that we're doing. So I want to read just an excerpt, actually, and I just think that it's something that I know many people have talked about, the power of her naming her not protecting me, and what does accountability look like now. So I wanted to just kind of read an excerpt from her chapter. She writes, "For these three decades, I could not understand why Aisha could not, quote unquote, just get over it. I was in denial about the great harm that had been done during and long after the actual molestations took place. There was the harm of Aisha's father and me acting normal around this man." And I just want to remind readers that this is my grandfather. "Never letting on to other family members that he was not as he appeared, but was someone who caused our daughter great harm. Who were we protecting for our own selfish reasons? Worse, we had expected our daughter to keep it a secret, to never tell her grandmother. It would kill her. We kept repeating over and over. Or all of the other family members who regularly gathered to celebrate birthdays and holidays over these three decades. We acted as if it was all normal. I never understood the tremendous harm I was inflicting on my daughter. What is worse, I never thought about what she must have been going through at all those parties, dinners, and gatherings held in the house. We wanted her to put it behind her, to forget about it, to not upset the happy family. I did not understand until August 2016 why Aisha was still angry with me and why our relationship was so troubled. I was oblivious to the fact that the harm continued way beyond the 2 years she was being actively molested. As a civil rights, women's rights, and human rights activist, I am shocked and ashamed of myself. I am ashamed that I let my only child, a woman child, suffer all these years in silence. I am ashamed that I did nothing, really, to take her out of the horrible situation she endured during and long after the molestations occurred, by wanting her to keep it quiet, to keep it secret, to go there regularly and act as if nothing had happened. I don't know how I did this. I am just now admitting and coming to terms with my inaction with this great evil that I covered up and expected Aisha to cover up. I am just now, 37 years later, coming to terms with the terrible spiritual, psychic, emotional, and physical toll that this has taken on Aisha for almost four decades. I am just now becoming accountable to her for the love I have always proclaimed that I have for my daughter. I am so sad about the overt and covert harm that I caused Aisha. I am grateful that in spite of this harm I have caused, Aisha has persevered, risen like a phoenix from the ashes, and held me accountable for my silence and for covering up a monstrous evil. She has broken silences with her film, Know the Rape documentary, with her numerous writings in print and online, her national and international lectures and workshops, and now with Love with Accountability. I can only pray that she forgives me and that I continue to learn from her example, her writings, and the personal experiences she shares with me on how a parent should act when one's child is sexually abused. And I'll just stop there.
Yeah, that, like you mentioned, you had the word breathe every couple chapters, and I was telling you beforehand, it was really, really needed because it's like you almost holding your breath at some point, you know? And to the statement
yes.
of why you can't get over it, like in the later chapters, there was a lady, I think she was in her 50s, and she was talking about she was 50 and she was abused as a child. And I forgot what triggered her, and she woke up and she had wet her bed. She was 50 years old.
That was Kalima Johnson. Kalima Johnson, who runs this incredible center in Detroit, Rape Crisis Center for Black Women Survivors, called the Sasha Center. Yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so it's like, don't, if you're listening to this, you know somebody's going through it, or you yourself have gone through it. One, I think if you yourself have gone through it, don't be too hard on yourself on the journey. Your journey may not look like somebody else's. Somebody else may somehow heal faster, if you will, but they can be triggered, or it may be up and down. It's like grief, you know, it's a grief, and grief comes in waves, and it can come 5 years, it can come 10 years, or it can come down the line and you're 50 years old. So for people who maybe it hasn't happened to but are on the sidelines, if you will, and you're like, why can't this person get over it? They're not the only ones who can't get over it, you know? And it shouldn't be.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a get over. It's a working with. It's a dealing with. Like I said, almost related like a grief. One of the interesting things is remaining friends or loving people that hurt you, because again, this is breaking the stereotype. It is not a stranger. It's usually somebody you know, and many times it could be somebody close. I mean, in the book, they talk about brothers molesting sisters. Cousins molesting cousins. One crazy story that really hit me like, bam, I think it was a young woman who was molesting her cousin, but she was also being abused at the same time, I think by the mother's boyfriend. It was like for 5 years, mm-hmm. she was abusing one of the writers. And then, but at the same time she was abusing, she was actually being abused.
Right. Well, and I think that that's the problem with that. With when we're talking about children, abuse is abuse. I want to be really clear. But and then there's something that happens when it's children, sibling abuse. And let me say that there have been sisters who are abusing. You know, that abuse, I think it's really important. Because, and let me just share with the readers that I have men writing about their abuse, gender non-binary
yes.
people writing about their abuse, that this
yes,
is something
do.
That
mm-hmm.
transcends all genders. I mean, for me, the commonality is that everyone is black, a diasporic black from the diaspora.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that so often, particularly as children, if they're being abused and it's not being addressed, that a lot of times children are acting out. And so on what has happened to them. And so I think that, and this is part of the reason why the carceral responses are very problematic for me, because I feel like if we see a child acting out, chances are they're either witnessing or experiencing harm and that they need help too. I'm talking about children. Now, once we get to adults, there's work that needs to happen there, but it's so pervasive, and we don't talk about it. And I think that sometimes people will talk about it because the person who's causing harm could be the breadwinner or, you know, the person who's, you know, in charge. So there's so many complex reasons not to excuse or condone why this is happening. But I think that that's why we have to have complex responses. For instance, my grandfather molested me, right? So we could say, oh, well, we need to lock them up. But I told my parents what happened. And so they also are culpable. And so, like, and as the case is that
should
for
they
most
be locked
instances
up as
of
well?
Abuse,
mm-hmm.
right, we can't lock yeah. up every – I don't believe in it at all, but we can't lock up everyone. Because chances are it's more than one person involved. People are looking the other way. So what are the ways in which we can address this? Where it's not on the survivor, the immediate survivor. I don't think they need to take that on. I think that this is why I'm talking about communal responses, family responses, where we hold that person accountable, while we also hold the person who's been harmed with love and care. But I think that this is kind of like, you know, either foster care or policing or whatever. It doesn't stop the harm. It doesn't, and sometimes it exacerbates it.
One of the things,
what, for me, love and accountability is about. Sorry.
Yeah, no. One of the things that I was just reading about wasn't necessarily in your book, but it is people say, okay, all sex offenders are the same and none of them can be healed. There are some therapists that believe depending on the issue, like if a sex offender is only interested in children, it is usually harder for them to not act out again. But if the person is, say, attracted to adults and children, they have a more chance, supposedly, of healing, so to speak, and through cognitive behavioral therapy, through things similar to, like, Alcoholic Anonymous types of groups and things like that. And even, I think, one of the writers talked about having the offenders speak out about what they're going through and what their process
mm-hmm.
is and what happened to them. Like, you know, the question a therapist usually asks, well, what happened to you? Like, why are you, what's going on that you are behaving this way? And maybe having them explain and share, which can heal them just by even speaking it out, because there's shame with them as well. I'm not trying to say that the victim is not shamed. I don't want to make it less, you know, more or less, but there is shame with the offender
mm-hmm.
as well, you know. And that's
there's
something you talk
change.
About in the book. Yeah, I had a problem. I think I told you we're running close to time, but I just want to say there was one situation. I think the woman or a person had been abused by their brother, and then they allowed their kids to go over their brother's house. Now, supposedly their kids were not abused. Me personally,
mm-hmm.
I couldn't have done that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not there yet. I'm not there. I do, though, agree that the prison industrial complex is not perfect and is not a place to help somebody who's been a victim, because your victims talk about that, you know? Did you ever go to the criminal justice system about your grandfather or any situation, the rape
I
or
never
anything?
Did. Well, my rape was on a study abroad program. I never used the criminal justice system it wasn't even presented as an option. And I want to say, you know, there's billions of dollars being poured into prison. And so one of the things that many of us who are abolitionists are working to change things around is, like, if we could even take a fraction of that money and put it into, like, healing centers. So it's not about just letting people who cause harm just not hold them accountable, but it's like, what's the kind of work that we can do? Because statistics show that when people are locked up and come out, that they will and not have any help or support, that they will harm again. And so for me, I'm interested
yes.
in transformation and healing. Everybody needs healing. And I speak as a survivor, so I want to be clear. And I'm very clear about my healing, but I'm clear that those people who cause harm need healing as well. And that's what I'm interested in.
Now let me
expense of the survivor.
You have the phrases in the book of restorative justice, transformative justice. What's the difference? What are the similarities?
Well, restorative justice tends to work within the system, so to speak, right? So that they're very rare that in terms of if criminally prosecuted, that you had in some courts you have the option to have a restorative justice process involved. Transformative justice does not work at all within the criminal justice system at all. But let me just say, restorative justice emerges from indigenous practices in terms of really believing in the wholeness of the community, that when one member is harmed, all of us are harmed. And for me, it was important to have writings by restorative justice practitioners and transformative justice practitioners. And it's also, I want to just share that there are people who in the anthology who share that they are opposed to the prison system and they believe we have to use what we have until we create something different. So I wanted to create a collage of voices and really kind of 40 distinct roadmaps, if you will, around this issue, because there isn't one story that fits one size solution that fits all. That it's going to take multiple visions. And
one
so,
of the things
you know,
I liked
really,
was,
go ahead.
No, go ahead. Multiple visions, and that's exactly what it does. It is a collage, and there's something for many. Every story is not the same, and yet there's similarities. Like we talked about the silencing, we talked about the shames, about the disbelief, about still loving people who were your abusers. But one of the interesting stories was the father and daughter that wrote. There was the story about the father. You want to tell them about that? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Pops and Ade, Adonike Harris and Peter Harris, they're father and daughter, incredible team, and the father was not involved with any of the harm. It was her stepfather who abused her, and they have an incredible TED Talk. You can look them up on Pops and Ade or Peter Harris and Adonike Harris, where they really talk about healing and really restorative justice and how to move from the trauma, and how does the father heal with his daughter, the father who was not involved, who was on the other coast, because he lives in California and her abuse happened on the East Coast. And it's really a call and response, their contribution. It started because this anthology was first in online form, so it was a video. And then I transcribed it, had it transcribed, and we made it a call and response. So I just exactly wanted to have images as well around just very different definitions of manhood, of parenting, just of experiences. So it's really powerful. And on my lovewithaccountability.com website, the forum is actually still live, so you can actually see some of those writings on the forum. Most of them are in the anthology, have been revised or updated. But for me, the Love with Accountability site is really a site for resources in terms of the forum, of books, of all, because of COVID, we couldn't do in-person book talks, so we did online book talks. So all of those videos are there where you can hear actually from most of the contributors reading from their pieces and talking about the work that's featured in the anthology.
You also have on YouTube, they have a cool music, and then you have the flashing images of the writer and a little blurb about who they are, and then
yeah,
along with that was really nice. It's about 25 minutes or something, but it was just nice to listen, something kind of soothing, even though it's this heavy topic, so that was nice. Also, I just want to bring up this issue of community accountability. So because we talk about the micro, which is the people close to the victim, the mother, the father, the aunt, the uncle, grandfather, mm-hmm. so to speak. But there's this community issue, and you bring that up with one of the stories dealing with the Ghanaian African community, I think it is, and how they brought the accused and the accuser together. And as a community, they decided to support the perpetrator and told the victim, yo, you can't do anything about this because it's really going to mess his life up.
Yeah.
I was
yeah, that piece is, yeah.
What? That was a community of people all in the room with this person, this child. And I was just like, whoa. That was one of the times I was really pissed. I was telling Aisha, like, I couldn't read this before I went to bed. Like, I kind of had to read up until about 10 o'clock, and I was like, all right, okay, we got to stop, because then I got to go to bed. So I had to watch something stupid or funny or something else, because I went through a range of emotions as well. But the transformative would include that change of the community, and that the community is aware of something going on and not doing anything. They also need to be held accountable. And our communities, such as our schools and our criminal justice systems, need to be held accountable. And I'm always a proponent of, if you see something and you don't like what's going on, why don't you make something up to change it, you know? Like, if you as a community person are out there and you're listening to this show, and one of the issues was, you know, talking to kids about mental health therapy. That was something that one of the writers, hey, go to your local elementary school or high school and say, hey, I got an hour a week, I'm interested in doing this, blah, 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 you know. Or, you know, the sexual abuse thing is a hard sell, but if you want to throw statistics at them and show, like, 1 in 3 girls or 1 in 6 boys are being abused, and then you think about people who are trans, LGBTQ community, anybody on the fringe, if you want to say that, may have a worse, and their stories are even further pushed away because they're not in the center of whatever we think the center is, you know, stand up and speak about it. You know, don't wait for, I don't know what, Aisha to make another story or another film.
Yeah. No, I think that it's really, it's very important. And I think, and again, another reason in terms of, I think, why schools don't want to touch it is, you know, we have these mandatory reporting laws that I think initially came from a good place, right? But I think that this is why there's so much silence, right? Because if children are being harmed, they're going to be removed from the home. And I'm not saying that a child should be in a situation where they're being harmed. I want to be really clear. But I think that we have got to come up with some alternatives where it doesn't result in some form of foster care, where they're in a stranger's home where they could also be harmed as well. I think that this is why we have to think about how can we respond in ways, the immediate survivor, but that also are about holistic responses and healing. And so I think that for me is that's the impetus for my work and like, I can't undo what was done to me as a child, but it's just really working hard to pay it forward with the young people in my life, and then with the young people that I don't even know who they are with this, through this resource, and, you know, just conversations and engagements. And like, when you talked about the video about that, was introducing all of the contributors to the anthology, I wanted, again, for that, for people to be able to enter into it, and it's on the homepage of the website as well as on my YouTube channel, like, for people to enter into the conversation. So, like, you may not be ready to read the book in its entirety, but at least it introduces you to each of the contributors and gives you a brief description of who of what their chapters are about. And it's a wide range. Like, I include, there are deaf contributors in the anthology, because what does it mean to be, and there are folks who are autistic. Like, what does it mean? Like, we're dealing with, you know, in terms of
and disabilities.
When you're dealing with disabilities and dependent, like, you are dependent on others. I mean, children are always dependent. I mean, I've been saying children are sheltering in place long before we were talking about sheltering in place. But then there's another layer of dependency when you're deaf, when you're autistic or physically disabled. And what if your caregiver is causing harm, or your caregiver is the only person who can care for you while parents are working? Like, all these kinds of things that we have to factor in and think about as we talk about this. And it is a pandemic. I mean, it's a pandemic. They say that there are 40 million childhood sexual abuse survivors, which is like the state of all of California and maybe, I think, some of Texas. And that's, as you said in the opening, Joy, that's just those who report it. We know it's more. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's so many more. So
where can people reach you, Aisha? I don't want to forget that. Like, on We have your Love with Accountability website. What about like on like Instagram, on Twitter, or
so? Social media is all at AfroLez, AFROLEZ. So that's Facebook, that's Twitter, and that's Instagram. It's all at AfroLez. And then there's the lovewithaccountability.com website for love for, and then the knowtherapedocumentary.org website. But if you follow, if you see me on social media, I have links that connect you to all the to the work. So at AfroLez on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter.
And I'm going to be giving some copies away of the book. So, again, you want to follow me at Joy Keys on Twitter. Also, check me out on Facebook, Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys, and on Instagram, Saturdays with Joy Keys. And you could probably win a copy of the book for free. That way, but we can support Aisha because you could buy a whole bunch for, like, I don't know, a school. Imagine that. A college or something, you know. Libraries are going out of business. Brick and mortar bookstores are going out of business. So if you actually got books for people, that'd be great. Or you could buy ebooks and send it to their Kindle or Nooks or whatever, you know. And you'll be supporting Aisha and her work. Now, what do you think is next for you? Do you think you will continue this journey of healing and dealing with child sexual abuse, or will you start talking about, like, I don't know, hot air balloons?
I'm working on a book project right now, which is going to, so it's a trilogy. So it started with No, it started with, and next with Love with Accountability, and my next project is called Love, Justice, and Dharma. And it is a memoir, so that No and Love with Accountability really, these are document, it's a documentary anthology that, where it's about the voices of, between the two works, of somewhere between 70 and 80 black survivors and advocates and stuff. So really talking about sexual violence. And now I'm going to do a deeper look in terms of my life and journey around trauma and healing, and the need to, again, for non-carceral responses to that. So that is my book project. I am also a mindfulness meditation teacher. So I'm really turning my work to focusing on contemplative practices and meditation. I teach classes, lead meditation. It is very instrumental in my own healing process and really wanting to offer these tools and resources for all, but specifically survivors, because, you know, we have to heal. And I think that there's so many of us who are wounded healers out in this world, and our trauma, we act out our trauma, speaking as someone who has done it. I'm not talking about, I don't act out my sexual trauma, but the rage can rear its head in all kinds of ways. So it is through my practices and definitely through therapy that I'm learning how to heal. And so that's the work, and that's part of this new book. It's not only, clearly I'll share about my trauma, I'll talk about the process because my parents are human rights activists. So what does it mean in terms of this, of them not advocating for global human rights all over the world, literally, and yet not protecting me? And then talking about my journey to healing. And so that's why it's Love, Justice, and Dharma. So that's the next project.
Well, I wish you success. I hope you come back on and talk about that. And again, check out her website, Love with Accountability. You can't mess that up. .com, and you can check out all the things there, and you can make donations there. You can contact her there, and you can, like you said, there's the forum and there's the YouTube channel. Lots of information and resources there. If you are someone who is dealing with child abuse, or you know somebody has, thank you so much, Aisha, for coming on the show tonight.
Thank you, Joy. It's really a gift to return and have an opportunity to talk about this topic. So thank you so much.
Well, I want you to come back on about the third book, but, you know, like, seriously, I need you to write about the hot air balloons, okay? I just want to put that in there, okay?
All right.
I'll talk to you later.
All right. Take care. Thank you. Bye.
You're welcome. thank you, everybody, for tuning in. Again, you can follow me on Twitter at Joy Keys. Also, check us out on Facebook, Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys, and on Instagram, Saturdays with Joy Keys. And you can check out the show on Stitcher, Spotify, iTunes, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, Google, and as well as here at Blog Talk Radio. You guys have a great evening.
What if you were wearing something sexy? What if you were drinking? What if you made the first move? No matter what, sexual assault is never your fault. Support is available 24/7 through the National Sexual Assault Hotline. Call 1-800-656-HOPE or visit RAIN.org. That's RAINN.org. This is Christina Ricci with RAIN, reminding you it's never your fault.
Brought to you by RAIN and this station.